Gang, the coronavirus is sweeping the nation, it's planted its roots, and most scientists are saying it's not going anywhere for a while. Those nasal swab tests are hard to get and they're very expensive. Well, our friends at ProResults are doing rapid COVID-19 antibody testing to let you know if you have had the virus. They take cash or credit, no insurance needed, no doctor appointment required, and you get the results in 15 minutes. Gang, I've taken the test 2 times. It's painless, it's quick, it's easy. And How Did I Get Here is partnered with ProResults, offering you 15% off COVID-19 antibody testing. Just go to ProResultsAustin.com/HDIGH. That's ProResultsAustin.com/HDIGH for 15% off COVID-19 antibody tests. Go get your tests. Let's get down.
You gotta open the vault.
Open my vault?
Open your vault.
Once I open the vault, it ceases to be a vault.
You have no choice.
Hey, the vault.
It's time for How Did I Get Here? From the vault. And now, here's your host, Johnny Gowdy.
All right. Hello, I'm Johnny. I'm your host. Welcome to the show. Welcome to another episode of How Did I Get Here from the Vault, where I go back into our hundreds of episodes and yank one out, polish it off, and re-put it out for you guys. Yeah, that's right. I take the intros off, but I think the outros all stay on them. So that's pretty funny. You go back to whatever year it is that I'm talking about. So today we're going back to episode 430. It came out on October 30th, 2015, almost 5 years ago, where I sat down and talked to singer-songwriter, UK singer-songwriter, Frank Turner. Amazing, amazing performer, amazing songwriter. And we had a really great conversation. We actually had the conversation right after his sound check backstage at Emo's up the street on Riverside. And then I ended up going to his in-store at Waterloo, and then I ended up going and seeing his band play that night at Emo's, and it was fucking great, man. That guy is amazing. He's got so much energy. He gives so much. And his connection with his audience, this is what I was going to add to the show, was when I was leaving the interview after his sound check before I went to Waterloo to see his in-store, I saw a lot of fans sitting outside in a line trying to be the first ones in because it's general admission. They wanted to get close to him. There was a lot of people out there. There were people that had driven in from all over. There were the Dallas and Houston kind of people, but there was also some people that had driven in from Chicago, and that someone was holding their place in line and they were going to go to Waterloo and see the in-store and then come back and see the show. It's very, very, very intense following, and it's because he's such an amazing performer and he puts so much into it. And I really had a great time sitting backstage talking to him. We had a fantastic conversation about record stores, the punk ethos, touring the U.S., and much, much more. Great, great conversation. The class system in England, I remember talking to him about that. Anyway, let's go back to episode 430 from October 30th, 2015, backstage at Emo's on Riverside with Frank Turner.
How did I get here from the vault?
Yeah, you know what's cool? You come from punk rock, from hard rock.
Yeah.
And I find that guys, do you know Jesse Malin?
I do know Jesse.
That was the best example I could think that crossed into a more singer-songwriter thing.
Yeah.
When you bring the punk ethos into that, and there's also like that same kind of thing in folk music.
Yeah, I mean, it's prefacing all of this with the fact that I didn't do any of these kind of calculations when shifting from one to the other. You know,
right.
It was a sort of a an instinctive move. But like, yeah, I think that the punk and folk have a lot in common, not least that they're two four-letter words that are argued about by people who need to get a hobby.
Right.
But I mean, I like the sort of iconoclasm of it, you know, and the sort of the communitarian aspects of it, I think, are really interesting and important to me.
Yeah. How did you grow up? Did you grow up in the class, which, you know, were you wealthier or
my parents are solidly middle class.
Yeah.
My upbringing was weird because I got an academic scholarship to a school for the rich, as it were, which means that it's sort of slightly short-circuited the British class system for me in a way. I hate the British class system. I hate talking about it. I hate being part of it. It's complete fucking bullshit judging people by what their parents do for a living.
Right.
And I don't think anyone should ever do that.
Right. So do you feel like that feeds that, like being the not rich kid in the rich kid school fed that sort of like punk rock, like,
Certainly. Well, I mean, as a teenager, because I mean, I went there when I was 13 years old, and which is it's sort of a time in life when you start figuring out some basic parameters about how the world works anyway. And it took me a little while to realize quite how ridiculous some of the kind of social mores of the place that I'd been imprisoned,
yeah,
as it were, you know. And I was very angry about when I sort of figured out. I mean, like the example I always think of is that like some of the kids at that school use the expression plebs to refer to anybody who isn't privately educated. I didn't really understand what that meant until I'd sort of thought about it for a bit. And then when I did figure out what it meant, I was filled with rage.
What does it mean?
Disgust. Well, plebeians.
Okay. Probably, right. Okay.
And I just think it's disgusting. And that was around the time when I kind of stumbled across like The Clash and the Sex Pistols and then Black Flag. And I certainly think the kind of the rage and kind of defiance and rejectionism, if you like, of stuff like Black Flag was helped me square a circle. It felt like a life raft.
Yeah. Yeah. That's like rock and roll saved your life.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm not sure they would have died otherwise.
No,
but it certainly gave me meaning and purpose and direction and hope.
Yeah. That's a great thing. How are you doing? How are you holding up through this tour? You guys, you've been hitting it hard, and you're doing like two shows a day. You're doing like record stores and stuff.
Yeah. Well, I've got two shows to come today.
Yeah.
But we had day off yesterday, so, you know, win some, lose some. Yeah. It's good. I mean, like, I've been touring for more than half of my life now, and I've been on the road probably more than I've been off it for the last 17 years. Well, no, definitely been on the road more than I've been off it for the last 17 years. And we had a bunch of time off at the end of last year, beginning of this year, to do with making a record, which I hated, and I'm very pleased to be back in my comfort zone.
You're a road dog.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I'm kind of slightly wary about applying terms like that to myself.
Okay.
Do you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
Like, I like, this is the thing I'm good at in life. This is the method of existence I find kind of doable and comfortable.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question. Can you write on the road? Are you?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
I always have done. I mean, I've never... The whole thing about... I have friends in bands who have, like, writing periods and stuff like that, and that seems completely weird to me. Writing as a thing that happens at a time and place of its own choosing, I don't really have any kind of say over when inspiration comes.
Do you put any pressure on yourself, like, get up every day and write a certain amount or anything like that?
No, I haven't to date. I mean, I'm very interested by stuff like... I'm a huge Nick Cave fan, and he's done that thing of... I don't know if you know about this. He, in his later period, he's treated songwriting as a 9-to-5 job. He has an office with a piano in. He goes in at 9 a.m. He works until midday, takes an hour for lunch, does the afternoon. And that's not something I've done, but I'm very interested as to what would happen were I to do that.
I've done it, and I'm a songwriter as well, and I feel like once that wheel is turning, you're just doing it all the time, so more good shit comes out, even though, you know, a good deal of it's crap.
I think it's a muscle to a degree.
Yeah,
you know?
Totally.
But I don't know, it's funny, it's a weird time to ask that, because I've just had quite a long period of not writing anything, which was semi-self-imposed, just in the sense that, like, I threw everything that I had into this last record we've done, which one should always do, of course.
Of course. It sounds like you do, by the way, and it's an amazing record. I've been listening to it for the last few days, and it's unbelievably beautiful. Yeah.
Thank you very much. But there's definitely a few, this is my sixth studio album, and I feel like it's kind of a piece, taking a longer view, it's of a piece with the preceding five records, and I sort of feel like now is a moment to take a step back and consider where I head next creatively. And with that in mind, I don't want to just keep writing in the same cycle. I like the idea of taking a break and then kind of coming back and deciding where I'm going to go and what I'm going to do.
Yeah. So it's interesting because everything you do is very organic. Like the record's very organic. I assume that you write these songs on your own on acoustic guitar. Do you write them like that?
Yeah, and then okay. I take them to the band. I mean, okay. I don't want to in any way belittle the Sleeping Soul's involvement in this because, like, the process... I mean, I guess on paper, I write the songs and then we collectively arrange them.
Sure.
But, of course, there's a degree of crossover between those processes. And when I'm writing, I know which musicians I'm writing to play with. And, indeed, when we're arranging, they'll, you know, verses and choruses might switch around or ideas present themselves, whatever it might be. So it's really not as cut and dried as all that. yes, at least in theory, I write the songs kind of for me and a guitar and then work them up from there.
Let me ask you a question about record stores, because you've been hitting these record stores here in America, and there's definitely been like this, you know, overwhelming crisis over the last, you know, decade and a half over selling music and how do you find American record stores? Like is Europe and England, are they going through the same? Record stores are closing?
Yes, very much so. I mean, well,
there's ones that thrive, like Waterloo is always doing great.
Yeah, you know? Totally. Well, I mean, I'm
sure Rough Trade
as
well.
Yeah, there's Rough Trade. I mean, there's Banquet Records in Kingston in London, which is my favorite record store in the world. Okay. The place is killer. I think that certainly there's been a lot of kind of, there's been, to quote Black Flag, a process of weeding out, certainly. Quite a radical one. I mean, I think the whole thing about the internet and music is the first thing there are two, I think, important statements that need to be made about the discussion before you have it, which people seem to miss. First of which is that I'm a musician. I care about music more than I care about business models.
Right.
And it's interesting, of course, to talk about business models, and one can fight for and work towards kind of more equitable models or whatever they might be. But at the end of the day, I care about music 1,000 times more than I care about economics, you know?
Yeah.
And secondly... It's depressing to me that the history of this corner of the music industry has been so combative. I think it's really sad that the reaction of the industry, and indeed some bands, to stuff like Napster was to consider it a fight between fans and bands. I think that's stupid. I think that the whole, to me, I mean, call me an idealist, but it strikes me that, at least in theory, bands and music fans want roughly the same things, which is that they want a system in which, you know, bands can create music, which can then be easily distributed to the people who want to hear it, and then they can have live shows, and then everyone who works hard makes a living. You know, these are the things that we want, and it shouldn't be right from the word go. It was that thing of it just being kind of like, you're fucking stealing from me, and I'm stealing from you, and, blah, 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 and suddenly everybody's on either sides of a trench.
Yeah,
you know, and that struck me as kind of really well. It's just a shame because I think that the history of the last 15 years has been everyone trying to kind of undo that idiocy at the beginning.
Yeah. Not to talk about myself, but it might make you laugh that I was signed to Lars Ulrich's label.
Oh, really?
In the summer of 2000, my record came out, like the summer of where we never heard from him again. Like we saw him at all the press shit, and then all of a sudden we just never saw him again, and we just saw him on TV yelling about people stealing music.
Yeah, totally. I was attempting to do all that without mentioning the man by name, but you beat me to it. I think, you know, it's... The business model used to be that the physical music made money, and therefore you did shows in order to promote that because that was the object that generated income. That's been flipped on its head. Physical music, you know, recorded music is no longer a revenue generating commodity, and the live show is. So, I mean, if you want to get into the economics of it, I'm interested by stuff like Madonna signing with Live Nation because I think that's entirely sensible in the sense that from a purely business point of view, recorded music serves to exist essentially as a flyer for a show because the show is the place where income is generated. And I think you'll see more and more bands signing with promoters.
And she did like 10 years. Like
yeah,
10-year
and
deal
essentially, I mean, I don't know what it is over here, but in London, Prince simultaneously released an album for free and announced 30 shows in a row at the O2.
Those are people that are smart and embrace what's happening and find a way to work with it.
Exactly. And I think that the industry will move more in that direction. There's also, it's worth kind of running up a flag for the vinyl resurgence, which is, of course, it is actually small fry in the grand scheme of things. I think people get a little overexcited about it, but it is a cool, self-sustaining, kind of vibrant corner of the music world. You know, people who do want physical music, and I think vinyl is the way forward for that.
Yeah, it's proven itself to be.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's good and healthy, and I release my stuff on vinyl, and that's good.
I saw it at Waterloo the other day.
Okay, great.
Yeah, when I was in there shopping. Yeah, the live show, I got to see quite a few performances of yours from festivals.
Right.
And then I saw an interview with you where you talked about how you did 27 festivals in one festival season. Is that right?
That was just in the UK, but yeah.
That was just in the UK.
Yeah.
Okay.
I did more festivals that summer, but they were outside the UK. The 27 was just UK.
And you camped at all those?
Yes, I did, and I wanted to kill myself afterwards. And I have never camped again since.
Really?
I'm not opposed to the idea of maybe camping in kind of like, you know, Yellowstone or something.
Right.
But I do not wish to ever camp at a music festival again, and I've fucking paid my dues. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, your performances are searing. Like, you know, you're a guy that leaves nothing, you know, you leave it all up there.
Well, thank you. I mean, that's certainly the intention.
I hope so. Yeah.
That's the intention. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, I always want to sort of phrase what I'm about to say whilst being polite to my sort of indie rock friends, but fuck it, we're all friends here. I'm going to be full on for a minute. I grew up with hardcore, essentially, was the music that I was obsessed with as a kid. And growing older, like, I mean, a lot of people, a lot of my friends in London kind of people came up more with the sort of like Strokes, Libertines kind of indie scene sort of thing. And I'm always just, I just laugh when you see kind of people going, oh yeah, like Suede really went for it last night. And it's like, no, they fucking didn't.
Yeah.
This thing was wearing a blazer.
Yeah.
If you can wear a blazer and not pass out, you're not trying hard enough. That's the fucking rule as far as I'm concerned. You know what I mean? And like, there's this weird sort of like, a lot of kind of more kind of indie rock, mainstream rock stuff about this kind of like, you see someone kind of vaguely stamping a foot and it's like, he's going crazy. And I think to myself, man, you have never seen Sick of It All live.
Yeah.
You know, and that's certainly my benchmark for what a live show should be. When we were A Million Dead, the band, I used to come off and like pass out when we were done.
Yeah.
Because every single tiny last piece of energy that I had would be left on the stage. And I want to do that now. And obviously the music I make isn't hardcore punk anymore.
No, but you have that energy, which was what I was trying to get at with that Jesse Malin thing. Just kind of like people that come from that world and go into, you know, that just kind of like blossom as singer-songwriters and take off on that career, they bring that energy with them like you have. They're incredibly dynamic.
Again, thank you. I mean, that's the intention. I'd like to kind of sort of perform Springsteen songs in the style of Sick of It All or something like that, you know? Like, it's just, there's something really kind of physical. I remember, like, a really big kind of life-changing moment for me was I went to see Jesus Lizard by accident when I was a teenager.
Jesus Lizard?
Yeah. They're one of my favorite bands now. Yeah, at the time, I didn't really know who they were.
Yeah.
My parents had it wasn't even that my mum had started letting me go into shows. I was banned from going to shows when I was like younger because my parents hate rock and roll. I'd sort of figured out ways of getting to shows and Jesus Lizard were playing and they were a punk band. So I was like, cool, I'm going to see that. And David Yao just jumped off the stage and got in the crowd before he'd sung a line of the first song. And I was just like, fuck me.
Yeah.
Like, and it was just so great because suddenly the show wasn't this thing happening over there that you can tune into or not tune into. The show was something happening 360 degrees around you.
Yeah.
And the audience were part of the show. And that's important to me as well. You know, sometimes people come up to me and go, oh, we had a, you know, thanks for the great show last night. And I want to say, well, thanks to you, because to be honest, you could play the set of your life to a shit crowd and it would be an average gig at best.
Yeah.
You know, a good show, as I'm sure you know, is made up at least kind of nearly 50% is made up of how the audience reacts to what you're doing.
Sure. You're communicating. And you're,
right, exactly.
You're
it's a dialogue rather than a monologue, or at least it should be.
Totally. Let me ask you this. What tour is this of the United States for you? Like, how many times have you been here?
I've got no idea.
A lot of times, huh?
Yeah, loads. I mean, it's sort of...
I saw you were on Letterman.
Yeah, we did that a few years ago. I mean, I did my first tour of the States in 2007. I did, like, me and a friend got in a car and drove around and played to know people in coffee shops.
How was that?
Long. Yeah. It gave me a real solid appreciation of how large this country is. So we did that, and then... I mean, since then, I did a bunch of solo tours kind of coming through for about 3 years. I did tours with Fake Problems, Look Mexico, Gaslight Anthem. I did a run with The Offspring, which was great but weird. And then the band started coming out in 2010.
Oh, so you were label mates with them, right? Or you were?
Yeah, I was. Yeah. And the band started coming out in 2010. And then we opened for Flogging Molly and for Dropkick Murphys and for Social Distortion were the three big ones we did. But we started headlining here in 2011. So, I mean, we've probably done like 20 US tours now. I have no idea.
Oh, it's great. Do you love it?
Yeah, I love it. I mean, I'm fascinated by it and kind of pretty hard in love with American culture. in all of its complexity and weirdness to me as an outsider. And I mean, an awful lot of people in England, and I say this as somebody who used to be one of them, have this, these like tediously kind of self-assured armchair theories about America.
Right.
And they've either never been here or they've been to New York, and it's kind of like fuck off, man.
Yeah,
You know, Stephen Fry. Are you familiar with Stephen Fry?
He's I know that
British
name.
Comedian, TV presenter type dude. He. I read an interview with him once where he said the great thing about America is every one statement you can make about it, the exact opposite is also true.
Yeah,
and I think that's fantastic because you know America is a country of like health obsessive, and it's a country of obese people, and it's a country of like you know gun nuts, and it's a country of people who hate guns, and it's a country of sort of extreme libertarianism and extreme kind of like social control as well and all this kind of thing. So it's endlessly fascinating and not simple and something to spend time with. It's funny that we're having this conversation to Austin as well, actually, because I went through a long period of time of thinking about moving here to Austin specifically.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't in the end just because I see my friends little enough as it is and I'd never see anyone if I moved here other than my Austin friends.
Right.
But,
do you have any music friends here?
I do.
Are you friends with Bob Schneider?
I know who Bob Schneider is. Okay. I've know the guys in Mineral.
Oh yeah,
they were like my fucking favorite.
Jay
band
Gomez.
Growing up.
Is Jay in that band?
I know Chris, the main guy, and Gabriel, and that crew from there. And then we've got the East Cameron Folk Corps. Those
They're all I just had them
tonight.
On the show a little while.
Oh, cool. They're all coming out tonight. And then I mean, more just kind of like I've got some promoter friends and that kind of thing around here.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a good town.
It is a good town. I met your tour mates, Skinny Lister, during South by Southwest. I did a interview with them and ended up going out with them one night. Like, I think it was, I think it was St. Patrick's Day. I was like, I felt like an old man trying to keep up with them.
They know how to drink that lot. I'm actually off the booze right now, which is an in novel experience for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How does that feel? Was it conscious? Were you like, I can't do this?
I drink too much when I'm at home. I used to drink quite a lot on tour as well, but you get older, you know, and everything starts hurting more. And the main thing, to be honest, is my voice. I can't drink half a bottle of whiskey every day and then sing two shows a day. It just doesn't work. But since I stopped drinking on the road, the shows we're playing have been getting better. My voice has been getting stronger. I think we're at the top of our game right now. I think we're playing better than we've ever played before. And that's obviously more important than anything else.
Yeah.
So I'm going to stick with it. Although the last show of this tour is on Friday in New Orleans, and God motherfucking damn it, am I having a beer once that show is done.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, I'm going to have a cold one.
Yeah. Have you spent much time there in New Orleans?
Not masses. No. We've been through a few times on tour. We've done House Blues a few times. And I'm excited about playing Voodoo Fest. That should be fun. But I mean, it is slightly like one of those things where it's like, we're going to play and then we're pretty much getting on a plane straight away afterwards. And, the schedule is at the moment is such that I'm actually almost looking forward to getting on the plane more than I am to hanging out in New Orleans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're going to go home and tour for a little bit and then come back here?
Yeah. Well, actually, we were supposed to have a week off between this tour and the UK tour, but we've actually just been booked in for some German TV in between. So we're flying New Orleans to Berlin, Berlin to North Wales to start the UK tour, so no days off anymore.
Where do you live in what's it, Meonstoke?
Oh, that's where I was born. I haven't been to Meonstoke for years. I was raised in Meonstoke, which is near Winchester, and I now live in North London.
Okay.
My dad's family are from North London, so I'm sort of in the fold.
What's the North London scene like? Is it art people living there?
It's interesting you say that, actually. There's kind of, as far as music goes and sort of the kind of music that I'm into, mm-hmm. there's sort of three areas in London right now. There's in South London, you've got like the kind of, that's the kind of punk squat scene, house show scene down there.
Right.
Which is really fun. Like, there's some friends of mine run a place called Asprey Castle, where it's just a house, which somehow their neighbors haven't stabbed them all to death yet. And they have these mad punk shows there. So there's that. East London is kind of like the Williamsburg, like Shoreditch, kind of Dalston kind of area, which is not to my taste personally.
Right.
And then Camden is the sort of historic rock bit of London, you know, it's where punk happen and where people wear leather jackets unashamedly kind of thing. And that's my hangout. I like it there because it's just, it's kind of unassuming. It's just, people just like the music they're into and that's it.
Yeah. Just regular people.
Yeah. Who want bars where they'll play good music.
Yeah. What, I was going to ask you, as an outsider coming here and you got to, you got to see sort of our weirdest political So, I mean, so far, I think in the history of America, our oddest outside of the 2000 election thing, but
yeah,
this Donald Trump thing and just kind of like this weird, what does that look like to somebody that's not from here? Are you like, oh yeah, I see what's going on? Or are you like, that's a guy from the fucking Apprentice?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, one of the reasons the Donald Trump thing kind of saddens and frustrates me is that it plays up to the kind of boring anti-American armchair sentiments that I was talking about
right.
earlier.
Yeah.
It plays exactly into those hands. And it frustrates me because I think that America is a much more interesting, intelligent, and varied country than Donald Trump.
Yeah.
You know, and it's annoying to see people who don't really know what they're talking about having their prejudice confirmed by one fat asshole with a stupid haircut. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I also don't think that he's serious. I don't think he's actually going to run. Just to throw my tuppence sure. into it. I think that he's upping his fee for TV appearances, and I think he'll drop out of the race.
what a horrible thing to do to everyone.
Yeah, no. Just to up your own. And fuck him for that. Yeah, and fuck him totally. For that. But as with every passing day, I'm less sure of that opinion. But certainly when he first showed up, I was like, no way he's actually going to run.
Yeah, because he's jumped in a couple of times and just jumped right out.
Yeah, I still think that he's not serious about the idea of... Because this is the thing, I mean, that a lot of people kind of forget is that actually being kind of chief executive of the most powerful country in the world is probably quite boring and shitty and stressful, and it's not like being the star of a TV show at all.
Or the boss of everything where you just say what you want and walk out of the room.
Yeah, it's about compromise and it's about adult sort of politics. Incidentally, with that in mind, and I know this might irritate a lot of people, I don't think he's quite as ridiculous, but I think that Bernie Sanders has a lot in common with Donald Trump in the sense I don't think he's anchored in reality in any meaningful way.
No, and it's just, you're right. I feel the same way too.
And I just think that idea of kind of like... I mean, my buddy Jay, who's opening this tour, Beans on Toast, one of my favorite people in the whole world. I love him to pieces, but he's like, he's very pro-Bernie Sanders, and he's got a line about, you know, take money from corporations given to like schools and hostels. And it's like, really, somebody has thought of that before, and if it was that easy and that simple, it would have happened.
They would do it. Yeah.
You know, the world is infinitely more complicated than that. And plus, I mean, everyone seems to have been glossing over the fact the guy's been in Washington for 30 plus years. I mean, he couldn't be any more a creature of the system.
Right.
He's got an excellent line in diverting attention away from that fact, but he is as Washington as they can possibly be.
In my opinion, I feel like it's so early in sort of the race where. Still yes. over a year out.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think it was a John Oliver line about like there are children who are going to be born by election time whose parents haven't met yet. You know, and it's true.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's an awful lot of ruin in a nation, as they say. I think there's more to come.
Yeah. Do you read? Are you a big reader?
Yes, very much so.
What can you? What's the last? What have you read on this tour so far?
I'm currently knee deep in Italo Calvino, who's an Italian novelist and short story writer. Who he wrote a series of books called series of stories called Cosmocomics, which are amazing. They're these kind of like he's a very kind of sort of experimental fiction writer.
Okay.
And he wrote a series of kind of short stories about astrophysics, which are seriously weird but great. So I'm enjoying those. I read a lot of economic theory and history and politics as well.
Was that where you were going to go? Like, was there ever a time when you were going to follow that? Like when you were in school?
Surface, as far as kind of like official interrogators are concerned, yes.
Yeah.
But I mean, on an emotional level, I don't think since I fell in love with rock and roll, I've ever really particularly wanted to do anything other than what I do now. Obviously, that's a facile statement. That doesn't mean that was always going to happen.
Right.
And indeed, it doesn't mean that it will happen for the rest of my life.
Right.
But I certainly like, I mean, with the scholarship that I got, and I went to the London School of Economics and this kind of thing, and I think my parents are very keen for me to do anything else other than what I actually do.
But they got to be proud now.
Yeah, you know what? My mom is on board. I'm completely estranged from my father, so I no longer know or care what he thinks about anything. But my mom has come around. I mean, the thing is, my parents are just, they're very small-C conservative. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They grew up in a world in which nobody was in bands. And when I started listening to Iron Maiden, they were just like, they had absolutely zero frame of reference for
it.
And then I started listening to kind of, you know, like, Converge and also like shit like Rise Against and Born Against, I was gonna say, you know, sort of aggressive militant underground hardcore, and they were just like, what
are you do you still follow metal, like any do you know the Sword, those guys from
I can't say that I do. I'm not very up to speed on to be honest, I'm not very up to speed on much. I mean, I have ambitions towards kind of being musicologist in the sense that I've recently been listening to all of the 70s AM country that I can possibly lay my hands on.
70s AM country? Oh, yeah.
It's a scene that I didn't know very much about, but there's a lot to learn. So I'm learning about that, and I've just spent 6 months buried in Northern Soul. I don't know if you know about Northern Soul. It's a British, the British musical dance club movement in the late 70s that was kind of the forerunner of Acid House. So I've been trying to kind of look into that as well. But I mean, because I'm kind of buried in all that sort of shit, people sort of ask me, hey, have you heard this new indie band of like 3 17-year-olds, and I go, no, I don't care at all. You know, if they're still around in 5 years, I'll pay attention.
Yeah. So. Yeah. What did you, outside of the metal and stuff, like, did you grow up listening to like pop stuff? Like,
no, I was, like, well, this is the thing. My experience of music was really kind of like upside down. I had no rock and roll in my life. I got into Iron Maiden because I was into Games Workshop. Do you know what I mean by Games Workshop? Like Orcs and Goblins, Dungeons and Dragons, type shit, little figurines. Yeah. And then I saw some Iron Maiden posters and thought they had something to do with that and thought they were cool, and then listened to Killers. Wow. And my entire universe jumped on its head. Also, the Freddie Mercury tribute concert in 92 was broadcast on TV, and me and my older sister sat and watched that kind of, you know, faces inches from the telly.
Yeah.
And saw Metallica and Guns N' Roses and Spinal Tap, who we didn't realize were a joke, and Queen and stuff like this. So, So I got heavily into metal, then via Nirvana got into punk rock and hardcore. And it wasn't until kind of like my late teens, early 20s that it was like, I should probably listen to Bob Dylan. I've heard he's a thing, you know, and Springsteen and the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and everything else, you know, and the Beach Boys. And then even going further back, like, well, not further back, but sort of further into like Elvis or Sam Cooke or like Aretha Franklin or whatever it might be. So, everything was kind of upside down for me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. It was Nebraska was the record that kind of turned you on.
I mean, is that just something? No, it's fine. But I mean, I think it might be on my Wikipedia page, which I have nothing to do with, I might add, as well. Nebraska was a big record for me. A bigger event for me in my life was the Johnny Cash American Recordings series.
Oh, yeah.
Volumes 1 to 4. I don't really count volume 5 because it sounds like grave robbing to me. You know, he'd already died in the Pro Tools, a bunch of shit he'd done in the studio. Brilliant. But yeah, the first one was that was, I mean, and again, given the upside down nature of my exposure to music, the thing about those records in particular and Nebraska was that it sort of had never occurred to me that one could be heavy in the context of being quiet before. There was a linear relationship in my head between volume and intensity.
Yeah.
And you know, I was used to kind of going to see Earth Crisis play and, you know, bands like that, where the singer would take their shirt off and scream in the front row, and that was the most intense part of the show.
Yeah.
And the idea of somebody finger picking and singing, if we talk about Nebraska, the last line of the first song in that record is heavier than anything Slayer have ever done ever. I mean, because when the judge asked me why I did what I'd done, I said, well, sir, I guess it's just a meanness in this world.
Yeah.
That fuck Rain and Blood, man, that's heavier than that. That's way heavier than that.
Yeah.
And he's whispering over a major chord being finger picked.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was news to me.
Yeah. Well, you've managed to be able to get that heaviness in your quiet times too, but just the level of dynamics that you reach. This record, Positive Songs for Negative People, is incredible. I suggest all people get out there and get it. frank-turner.com.
Yes, that's
and you will be returning to the States.
Yeah, well, we're back over in December for some radio shows, and we're going to Mexico for the first time, which I'm very excited about.
Oh, right.
Never been there before. Very excited about going there. Also, not least, I mean, I know the one part of the world I haven't visited is Central and South America, and I've got a lot of fans over there because they email me endlessly, which is great.
Yeah.
And we're finally going south of the Rio Grande in December.
Yeah.
Not that far south, but it's progress.
You hitting Mexico City or something?
Mexico City, okay. Guadalajara, and Monterrey. So we're doing
fantastic,
three shows down
man.
There. So I'm very excited about, and then we're going to, then we'll be back in the States. We've got a short run of shows, but we're going to be back over here for probably half of next year, all in.
Great.
I can't say any more about details about where or when, but I'm going to be in America a lot next year.
Good. Well, it was really nice meeting you.
Thanks.
Have a great
me.
In store and a great show tonight. And thanks a lot for doing
thank
the show.
See you at the gig.
Yeah.
Thanks, man. The preachers and the scientists got soaked just the same,
and we wondered if they'd ever get dry again. Amazing dude. Super smart, super thoughtful, amazing songwriter, fantastic performer, great solo show at the Waterloo that day, an amazing show that night with Frank Turner and the Sleeping Souls, his band at Emo's that night. His album, Positive Songs for Negative People, is available. Go to frank-turner.com for all your Frank Turner needs. Thank you, Frank, for taking the time to sit down and talk. Great conversation. Great dude. Hey, listen, man, while you're out there on the internet looking up Frank Turner stuff, don't forget you can like our Facebook page. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. And you can find us on Stitcher. You can find us on all kinds of mediums. And get out there. Get involved. Like our Facebook page. You can see photos. See a photo of me talking to Frank Turner backstage at Emo's the other day. Great conversation. I hope everyone has a great weekend. Happy Halloween. That's a big thing that's going on tomorrow. Happy Halloween, everyone. If you're in Austin, Skyrocket, my band, will be playing at Cedar Street Courtyard. Halloween night, doing it up, dressing up like a freak. I don't know what I'm going to be yet, so put on your freak clothes and come on out. Everybody, pick up Positive Songs for Negative People, Frank Turner's sixth studio album. It's also available on vinyl, which I love. And let's hear some more music. Let's hear the song Josephine from his album Positive Songs for Negative People. Here's some more music from Frank Turner. Thank you, Frank Turner, for coming by. Thank you for listening to the show. Have a great Halloween. Have a great weekend. Let's get down.
Dream. And I don't usually set too much store by the things these things might mean, but it was spoken with seriousness, more of a whisper than a scream. So now I'm waiting on some Josephine to show herself to me. I could have been anyone I imagined I could be. I just from my sleep. I could have been Napoleon, could have been Beethoven, could have been anyone but a comfortable me. So come on now, Josephine, show yourself to me. Come on now, Josephine, give me what I need. I don't like to be needy, but needs must. I can't stand being the person that I've been. I'm an impending car crash, and you're the first one on the scene. I'm a defeated commander, I'm a half-deaf composer.